From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, the effort to protect the Great Lakes from invasives goes well inland.
What's happening on the forest really does influence the lakes, and what happens in the lakes influences the forest. Invasive species are a two-way street.
Later, why it's hard to test for performance-enhancing drugs and how the tables might someday turn.
Chemists have been experimenting with these drugs, and it's very easy to modify these compounds a little bit so they become undetectable by standard tests, but still effective at what they're trying to accomplish in the body.
And we'll revisit one memory of 9/11 12 years later. Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. It's great to have you listening today. Lake Michigan is always prominent in Milwaukee, but all the Great Lakes are getting attention here this week. The Great Lakes Commission held its annual meeting here on Monday, and Great Lakes Week events have attracted water scientists and advocates from around the U.S. and Canada. Among them are members of a federal task force focusing on the health of the Great Lakes ecosystem. The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative includes 11 federal agencies. One of those is the Department of Agriculture, which includes the U.S. Forest Service. It turns out that the health of forests has quite a bit to do with the health of the lakes. Anthony Erba and John Roethlisberger work in the Forest Service's Eastern Region headquarters here in Milwaukee, and they're with us in the studio now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for inviting us.
What are the physical links, either direct or indirect, between the forest system, the system of national forests, both in Wisconsin and elsewhere, and the Great Lakes system?
Not surprisingly, one of the most important physical links between the forests and the Great Lakes themselves is that they're connected by water. In the Great Lakes Basin, everything outside of the Great Lakes themselves, the water bodies proper, is uphill. So when water falls on that landscape through precipitation, rain, snow, what have you, it gradually runs downhill and finds its way into small headwater streams, which then flow downhill and join up with one another and become larger and larger streams and eventually rivers, which make their way into the Great Lakes. So water is really a great integrator of the landscape in the Great Lakes Basin, or watershed, as we call it, and the lakes themselves. So the cleanliness of that water that ends up in the Great Lakes, that's here in Lake Michigan on the lakefront in Milwaukee, is a result of what's happened on the landscape in those headwaters and then gradually on down to the lakes. And forests are a really, really important component of the environment that helps to keep that water clean and fresh and abundant.
How does what happens in the forest impact the lake ecosystem? I mean, what is it that you do to manage forests and the resources within the forests that you can say, you know, what we've done here has a positive, or what we haven't done has a negative impact on what eventually reaches Lake Michigan or Lake Erie or
sure.
Lake Ontario or wherever?
And they're all connected, of course.
Well, I think that one of the things that's interesting about this week being Great Lakes Week, and the Environmental Protection Agency is a prominent agency that we all work with on the Great Lakes ecosystem restoration, is I've heard the kind of the layman's term that, you know, the forests are the kidneys to the Great Lakes. They actually help cleanse a lot of the water before it arrives into the Great Lake itself. And so whatever happens upstream from that, the forested systems are basically biological filters for whatever nutrients or excess of pollutants come out, actually gets absorbed by vegetation, gets absorbed by the stream banks and the soils themselves, so that when the water enters the Great Lakes itself, they are a lot cleaner perhaps than when they started.
Well, and so what are what are specifically the kinds of projects that you do within the national forests, say the Shawamigan Nicolet or
sure.
any of the national forests that might filter water before it reaches the Great Lakes ecosystem to impact the water?
So there are things that we do on one hand to protect water quality and the ecological services that the streams and lakes and wetlands provide. And then on the other hand, there are things that we do to try to restore those environments. So on the protection side, whenever we are sometimes on national forests, timber is harvested. That's part of what national forests do. They provide a sustainable timber supply. When we're going about those projects to harvest timber, we always make sure to leave a wide buffer around any aquatic environment, whether it's a wetland, temporary stream, or a perennial stream. There's always a buffer, and lakes as well. There's always a buffer left around that water body. And that allows for the filtration, the biological activity in the soil and through the vegetation, which prevents sediment from going into the streams. Other things we do have to do with building roads. Sometimes we build roads for people to access campsites or timber harvesters to get in and do the harvest. We make sure that when we build those roads, we build them in a way that's as environmentally sensitive as possible. We make sure that the drainage of the roads is set such that it's not dumping large quantities of sediment into the streams. We make sure that if there is a road or a trail on a national forest that's causing any sort of erosion problem, we go in and repair that by doing erosion reduction measures, building water bars, or stabilizing the bank of a stream. And then finally, one I'll add, and we can go on. There's all kinds of things we do on national forests. But talked about water and that physical connection. There's also a biological connection between the lakes and the forests and those streams that flow from the headwaters in the forest down to the lakes. And that's with migratory fish. So there are a variety of fish in the Great Lakes which spend their lives, the majority of their lives in the lakes, and then swim upstream to spawn, including on national forest lands. And sometimes, as we've done projects in our society to build roads, we block off the passage that they need to move upstream. And in the national forests, we're working really hard to remove those blocked passage ways that the fish need to move upstream, whether it be from a culvert that was built to allow road to go over or a small dam or what have you. We're working to restore the connectivity on those stream systems by building bridges or bigger culverts and trying to simulate the natural stream environment.
You know, one of the things that John's been focusing on is the national forest system with the Forest Service, and that's a really big part of what we do and what people really recognize. We have two other branches of the agency that are probably, for at least the urban populations, are probably just as important, and that would be our state and private forestry branch and our research and development branch. These two branches actually get involved a lot more with the urban populations, trying to figure out from the research side what research is out there, what scientific information is out there to help people understand the ecosystems. And certainly within the urban settings, they've been, you know, you can say, you know, highly modified from what they are out in the national forest. And the state and private forestry branch offers a lot of financial assistance as well as expertise in working with communities, both rural communities and urban communities, to develop, say, like green infrastructure. Again, trying to figure out these biological systems that filter water so water is cleaner for people's use.
Almost like you're helping develop the corridor that actually leads from where the end of the national forest is to where the beginning of the Great Lakes is.
When you leave the national forest and you go into either private land or state land, other agencies come into play, like the Natural Resource Conservation Service, the NRCS, which is also a partner agency in the USDA. They work a lot with farmers, specifically on phosphorus and how phosphorus is being used and how it's coming off agricultural fields, going into the water, showing up in the Great Lakes, then produces what we would consider to be harmful algal blooms. So you have nutrient pollution that goes on. So the conjunction that goes on between the two agencies, you know, we focus on national forests, and NRCS focuses on agricultural lands. And then you have our two branches focusing on urban communities. There's a lot of attention on water sources that enter the Great Lakes, and we're doing our best to try and restore impaired systems.
One of the issues we hear a lot about in terms of the Great Lakes is the issue of invasive species, both animal and plant species. Are there parallels between the invasives issue as it's playing out in the Great Lakes and what you're seeing on a national forest?
Oh, certainly. In fact, the one of the things I would say that's receiving increased focus right now is invasives in general. We do have staff here in Milwaukee that are part of a subgroup with other federal agencies looking at invasives as generically, looking at both plant and animal. What we're trying to figure out also is getting an increased focus on terrestrial plant invasives as well as aquatic plant invasives. So that, again, upstream caretaking of terrestrial considerations helps downstream use.
What's happening on the forest really does influence the lakes, and what happens in the lakes influences the forest. Invasive species are a two-way street. As non-native species come in from overseas on international shipping vessels, for example, and release ballast water into the Great Lakes, sometimes that introduces new aquatic species, which can then be transferred to lakes on national forests. The spiny water flea is a great example. We suspect that spiny water flea, which is a little, not quite microscopic crustacean, but a predatory zooplankton, came in from the Baltic Sea and invaded the Great Lakes, and now it's in a number of lakes on national forests. And we're working hard, including with funds from the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, to prevent that invasive species, along with a whole myriad of others, from spreading beyond those inland lakes that it's already invaded to other inland lakes on national forests and beyond. We do that with education programs where we teach people what they can do to take steps to prevent the movement of species inadvertently as they move around their boats and trailers and fishing equipment. And we also provide some resources for them to clean off their equipment. We've built some self-service boat washing stations on lakes in national forests. And we've also staffed portable boat washing units that move around and try to help people clean off their boats. So that's an important way. But also, as non-native species that have been introduced to the United States by means other than transoceanic shipping are moving eastward, for example, folks that visit national forests and pick up species there may possibly introduce them to the Great Lakes. An example of that is New Zealand mud snail, which first took hold in the U.S. out west, and it's gradually moved through Yellowstone and getting closer and closer to the Great Lakes. And a lot of that's been through anglers being out, moving around their gear, and then eventually visiting the Great Lakes. And now we have populations of New Zealand mud snail in Lake Superior, Lake Erie, and other locations in the Great Lakes. So I just want to emphasize it's a two-way street, and what happens in the Great Lakes can affect forests, and what happens on forests comes to the Great Lakes.
Do you have the manpower, the resources to effectively manage this interaction? Is this a success story, a work in progress? Where are things?
I think for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative as a whole, it is a huge success story. If you look at the cumulative investment so far, we're talking over $1 billion have come into this region of the United States, managed by 13 different federal agencies and all their staffs. The cooperation, the collaboration that has to go on amongst all those people. And they're, again, they're from different departments of the federal government. So a lot of times we don't deal with a lot of these people on a regular basis. And so just trying to work our way through that, we're finding that we may not have personally the manpower to do all this, but if we link up with other people to and other agencies to do the work, we're finding that we're actually getting a very, very nice outcome. It will show, I think it has been showing, in a lot of the stakeholder input we've received on preparing for the next action plan, which would be eligible for 2015 through 2019. A lot of positive feedback in public meetings and written comments, people really expressing a lot of enjoyment as well as satisfaction in seeing the changed conditions at the lakes, the changed conditions at the shoreline, different than what they grew up with.
Well, Anthony Erba, John Roethlisberger, thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Anthony Erba is the Director of Planning, Appeals, Litigation, and Landscape Scale Conservation, and John Roethlisberger is an aquatic ecologist with the U.S. Forest Service's Eastern Region Headquarters in Milwaukee. You can find a slideshow of pictures of the agency's work linked to water quality at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take a break now, and in a moment, learn about the tricky business of testing for performance-enhancing drugs in sports. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
Instead of finishing out the baseball season, Milwaukee Brewers outfielder Ryan Braun is at work volunteering and apologizing to fans. He's one of a dozen players on suspension for ties to a clinic that allegedly provided performance-enhancing drugs. But none of the players actually tested positive for illegal drug use, except Braun in an earlier incident that was dismissed on a chain of custody technicality. Dr. Ruben Baylor says that's because it's simply hard to catch users of steroids and other performance-enhancing drugs. Baylor is the main health scientist at the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Baylor says as quickly as labs develop new tests, illegitimate chemists create drugs to evade them. He tells Lake Effect's Amy Kiley about a surprisingly simple idea helping labs win that race. But first, he explains just how steroids work.
Anabolic steroids we're talking about, not steroids in general. There is a family, a very complex family of compounds. We're interested here in this context with the so-called androgenic anabolic steroids, which are compounds that are related to testosterone, which is the male hormone, sex hormone. These are a set of chemicals that can induce muscle growth in under anaerobic conditions. So they are used for many purposes, some medical uses, some legitimate medical uses, but in the context of what we're talking today, the abuse of anabolic steroids, they're used as performance-enhancing drugs because, as everybody knows, or most everybody knows, they can enhance the effectiveness of training, of weight training and aerobic training in promoting muscle growth.
What do steroids do in terms of that weight training that practice or additional exercise can't do?
They minimize or reduce the time needed to heal. Actually, what people do when they weight train, they are destroying muscle. They grow it and they grow it to the point where there is actually injury to the muscle fibers. So, and when those muscle fibers regenerate to heal, they outgrow the previous stage, the previous level, and they overshoot and they grow more than before. So it's this cycle of destruction and recovery, destruction and rebuilding, really what promotes the additional growth, and this is what bodybuilders do on a regular basis. They destroy their muscles and they build it up again. Now, this entails some time. There is a recovery time, a natural recovery time for the muscles that they need to go through with proper diet, and what steroids do essentially is reduce that time, and they can enhance the entire, make the entire process more efficient, but less natural and more dangerous because the body is not really built to endure that enhanced, extra or supra-physiologically efficient way of rebuilding the injured muscle.
What kinds of steroids did pro baseball players possibly use, and how did they become a factor in the sport?
How did they become a factor in the sport? Well, I really don't know what the entire history, but the steroids have been used for many, many decades just because of their properties. They've been used medically probably before for stunted growth, for conditions such as hypogonadism. So people must have noticed that these compounds induce growth. They promote growth. So people must have been experimenting. And we have stories dating back to the 50s or 60s, I believe, some gymnasts groups in the former Soviet republics, Soviet Union, German teams have very long histories and quite dark history of forcing these compounds to their athletes. And this is why for so many years they have performed at extraordinary levels. These athletes now are 50, 60, 70 years old, and they are facing all the adverse consequences of very heavy dosage of these compounds that are very dangerous. They didn't know at that point what the long-term outcomes might be. Now we do, and these women are facing really tremendous side effects of that very intense history with substance abuse. They weren't calling them substance abuse at that time, but it was clearly a program designed to enhance performance, in spite of the fact that they did not really know what the long-term consequences of that would be.
And what are those consequences, both in the short-term and the long-term?
Well, because these compounds are related to a sex hormone, testosterone, introducing them on a regular basis really wreaks havoc with the entire hormonal system. So when they are used by, particularly by young athletes or young individuals, where this carefully balanced homeostasis of hormonal factors during sex development, during maturation, is so critical, they can really cause a lot of trouble. So For example, in boys, you see an entire range of sexually related adverse outcomes like gynecomastia, which is the development of breasts, for example. You see acne, a lot of acne. You see hair loss. You see a deepening of the voice in girls. You see a recrudescence or a shrinking of the testicles in some cases. When the use is chronic for a very long time, there could be transient impotence and loss of fertility. And also you see disruptions of the menstrual cycle in women. There's a whole range of effects that are related to the disruption of these carefully balanced hormonal levels in both males and females.
How do labs test athletes for steroid use, and why does testing seem to miss so much of the drug use?
This is a very good question. The typical steroids that have been used since the Germans and the Russians were using them decades ago, chemists have been experimenting with these drugs, and it's very easy to modify these compounds a little bit so they become undetectable by standard tests, but still effective at what they're trying to accomplish in the body. So standard tests for detecting drugs in the blood or in the urine are very good when they are optimized for a very specific compound, whether they use antibodies or chemical reactions. But it takes time to develop these very specific tests. So it really comes down to a cat and mouse game when illegitimate chemists can develop very minor modifications that can really bypass standard detection tests. It's very easy to use products that will become invisible for a while to the tests. And this is why the anti-doping organizations, national and international, are now getting into the regular routine use of frozen samples. They're freezing urine samples just in case there is a suspicion in the future. So those samples could be defrosted in the future and exposed to newer tests that were not available at the time of the drug use. So we are constantly developing new tests because the chemists that are in this line of work, they're developing constantly newly modified, slightly modified molecules that look like testosterone or some of these anabolic steroids, synthetic designer steroids that for a while are able to bypass standard testing.
That's really interesting in that at the Biogenesis Clinic, none of the athletes actually tested positive. Does that mean that if we go back and look at those records later, maybe tests will be able to determine who did take steroids there concretely?
It's very, very possible. That's why it's so important to publicize the fact that people, these agencies, are now freezing the samples, keeping them for future possible use.
And the first time Ryan Braun faced allegations of steroid use, he got off on a chain of custody technicality. Why is chain of custody so important?
I can't really talk about specific cases, but chain of custody is important in generally speaking. It's critically important for when you're talking about criminality in general. It's very important to know that the evidence has been properly stored, properly managed, manipulated in a way that hasn't been tainted or contaminated or disrupted or modified in any way. So there has to be a very robust mechanism in place to ensure that the sample is intact, that hasn't been modified, so the results of any testing can be trusted by everybody.
Have you heard of any stories of samples being tainted in a chain of custody problem, like someone affecting the sample intentionally?
No, I'm not aware of any specific cases.
So in baseball, some people get asterisks next to their baseball statistics or denial from the Hall of Fame. Can science maybe someday retroactively determine who should get into the Hall of Fame and who shouldn't?
Well, science is in many, many different businesses. One business that science is not in is in determining who is in the Hall of Fame. So all we can say is that we can go back to samples and determine scientifically whether a sample that has been frozen and for which a test now becomes available, is a, there's a suspicion, it can be retested and retested for many, many, many times. But beyond that, it really falls under the umbrella of something different that has nothing to do with science.
Fair enough. So if Ryan Braun and others did use steroids and they stopped taking them, will their bodies go into withdrawal of some sort?
Well, steroids are, and again, I'm not talking specifically about this case, but in general, steroids are not euphorogenic. They can be addictive, but they fall more under a class of behavioral addictive conditions rather than drug addictions. Steroids don't really affect the dopamine system the way stimulants or opiates do. So they really don't cause a high. That's not what people using steroids are seeking, are after. They're after this performance enhancement. They're after shaping their body. So it's really more a drug-mediated or drug-dependent behavioral addiction. In many cases, this addiction can be as bad or worse than many drug-induced addictions, because becoming addicted to a way that your body looks like could be powerfully addictive for some individuals. Some of the long-term consequences of steroid abuse have been linked. There has been associations with mental illness, depression, and in some cases with rage and violence, very abnormally aggressive behaviors. And some people are at higher risk. Not everybody, but some people are at higher risk for suffering these acute and long-term consequences of steroid abuse, which can affect very complex, intricate systems in the brain that affect behavior.
How would professional baseball change if everyone who's allegedly using illegal performance-enhancing drugs stopped doing so?
I have no way of knowing, but I guess sports were a lot of fun before PEDs or performance-enhancing drugs were available, or the ones that we have today. So I have no way of knowing. We would go back to a level playing field. Now, in this context, it's important to know that a lot of people now, because there is this perception that is so pervasive, that the use of steroids is so pervasive, there is kind of a new factor entering into the equation, which is the peer pressure. People that would not have used performance-enhancing drugs before under different conditions, now they feel, perhaps legitimately, that if they don't use, they would be playing at a disadvantage. So the entire system now becomes a very vicious cycle that needs to be dealt with. This is a serious problem, not only because of the medical consequences, but as you suggest, because the entire world of sport really is really tainted, and nobody wants to see a proliferation of these asterisks.
Any last words of advice to a teenage athlete who's considering trying this?
Well, there is a lot of information out there. The last thing that a teenager wants is somebody telling them, don't do this, don't do that. So I would suggest that they take the initiative and inform themselves. There is a lot of good information out there. They can start with our website. The NIDA website has a lot of information. Particularly, we have a section in our website specifically designed for teens where they can learn a lot about performance-enhancing drugs abuse and other types of abuse. So I would tell them that they are responsible for their future and their health, and they have to take the initiative. If they are interested in a successful, long, healthy life, they should start by informing themselves about the real dangers of these and other forms of drug abuse.
Dr. Reuben Baylor, thank you for being on Lake Effect.
My pleasure.
Dr. Reuben Baylor is a health scientist at the National Institute on Drug Abuse. He spoke with Lake Effect's Amy Kiley. Following their conversation, Amy contacted Major League Baseball to find out if it freezes samples. Hypothetically, doing so could enable Ryan Braun and other suspended players to test positive for steroid use down the line. Major League Baseball spokesman Mike Thieben says in an email, quote, "Our collection and laboratory procedures do not include procedures for freezing samples. Any changes to our program must be collectively bargained between Major League Baseball and the MLB Players Association." He says recent changes include, quote, "unprecedented steps in American professional sports, such as blood testing for human growth hormone, a longitudinal profiling program tracking TE ratios, and IRMS analysis." A press release in which the league explains its testing procedures is at WUWM.com/lakeeffect. An essayist has some thoughts on the situation Ryan Braun finds himself in when we return on Lake Effect from WUWM. It's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Without a local pennant race, the last few weeks of the Brewers' season give fans plenty of time to think about their fallen hero, Ryan Braun. Lake Effect essayist Paul Hines suggests this week in particular would be a good time for Braun to do some soul-searching as well.
In 2004, after Paul Molitor was elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame, a friend of mine wrote to me, "The Brewers will never have more than two players in the Baseball Hall of Fame, ever. That sucks." It was hard to argue with the sentiment. As a franchise, the crew was pathetic. They hadn't finished above 500 since 1992. They had just traded away their best player, Richie Sexson. and the lure of Miller Park was already waning after only 3 years. In short, there was little reason to be optimistic for baseball in Milwaukee. And then, two things happened. In 2005, 21-year-old Prince Fielder took his first at-bat as a major leaguer. And 2 years later, Ryan Braun entered the picture. Suddenly, the idea of having a winning season, and, dare we jump the gun just a bit too quickly, a future Hall of Famer, didn't seem so far-fetched. Fielder played 6 seasons for the Brewers before leaving for Detroit, and though he rejected a long-term contract with Milwaukee, fans can look back on his tenure here with fondness. But Braun did something no one expected. He decided to be the man, the franchise player on a small market team, extending his contract to keep him in Milwaukee through the 2020 season. It was a dream come true for Brewer fans. Finally, finally, someone decided to take the high road and actually chose to stay in Milwaukee. Which is why the recent scandal involving Braun is so monstrously unfair. Not to him, but to us. Finally, a small market team reels in the perfect player with the perfect contract, only to find out that they were sold a bill of goods. In 2011, just 18 games into Braun's MVP season, he said, quote, "I truly believe I can get much better as a player. These first 18 games are probably the best baseball I've played in my career, and I really believe that's a sign of things to come." Well, of course it was a sign of things to come. He was cheating. Now the Brewers are stuck with a sorry excuse for a human being and, very possibly, a mediocre ball player for the next 7 seasons, an eternity in baseball. They'll have to pay Braun a total of $117 million. This for a team whose total payroll last year was $88 million. What's worse is that Milwaukee fans, who've had so little to celebrate these past 30 years, will no longer be able to look back on 2011 with any pride. The Brewers' first division title in 29 years was a lie. The Brewers' first MVP in 29 years was also a lie. Milwaukee fans might not be so quick to forgive a man who stooped to such inordinate lows as Braun, who was not only willing to cheat, but also willing to hurt other people's reputations to further his own career. If there's a team willing to take on over $100 million of tarnished goods, I'm sure Brewer GM Doug Melvin is all ears. Perhaps Braun can take an active part in this year's high holidays of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. After all, he won't be playing baseball, so he has no excuse not to participate in beginning the long, hard, arduous journey of contrition and ultimately, if he's very lucky, redemption.
Paul Hines is a writer, musician, and former Wisconsinite who now lives in the Chicago area. Once upon a time, way back when, Ryan Braun was just another prospect in the Brewers farm system, along with hundreds of other young ball players. Earlier this year, Lake Effect alum and rising music star Trapper Shep joined us in the performance studio, and he played a baseball song for us.
Dear prospect, won't you please pick me? Last season I hit a 370, and when I stand behind the plate, I'm hoping you're there to see. Dear prospect, please pick me. The Detroit Tigers, the Minnesota Twins, they all wrote me letters saying I'd be in, but when that draft day came, I never saw my name. My father hung his head in shame. Dear prospect, did you forget about me? I'll be your cleanup hitter, I'll play utility, and when I stand behind the plate, I'll be batting lefty. Dear prospect, please pick me. I'm sick of playing ball for this university. Wish I was out on the diamond in the big leagues. I should have took that offer when I was 17. Instead, I majored in marketing. Dear prospect, won't you please call me at 414-588-9223. And when I hear that phone ring, my mama's gonna sing, take me out to the ball game. that prospect, it finally took me. In the 24th round, he said I was gonna be in L.A. Dodger, mama, I'm gonna be a star. Hitting balls on Sunset Boulevard. Be hitting home runs on the Sunset Boulevard.
Trapper Shep playing Deer Prospect in the Lake Effect Performance Studio this summer. He'll play a solo set next Tuesday at Shank Hall, opening for Rhett Miller. One last break, then a transplanted New Yorker shares a 9/11 memory. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. It's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today marks the 12th anniversary of the terrorist attacks that crashed airplanes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and killed thousands. On the 10th anniversary, we aired an extended piece by Lake Effect essayist Linda Benjamin, which we're bringing back for today's show. It's called New Yorker in Milwaukee, September 11th, 2001.
My husband and I had moved to Milwaukee from New York for his work. And though I had no family in Milwaukee, my cousin Carol from Urbana, Illinois, came out to visit me. She came by around breakfast time, and we walked outdoors into a lovely, balmy, Indian summer kind of Wisconsin day. We had our breakfast near where I lived then, not far from the Downer Theater, Schwartz's Bookstore, Einstein Bagels, Starbucks, and Sendix. Carol and I returned from Einstein's with leftovers for my son Dan, who was living with me and my husband as he took his pre-med classes at UWM. And just as we entered the apartment, my phone rang. It was my husband. He didn't say hello, and I don't recall his saying my name. He said the following: Josh probably isn't at work yet. A total non sequitur. How strange, I thought. Why does he care whether Josh was at work yet, and why would I care? My older son Josh had finished his New York stockbroker's exams and landed a job with an investment firm. He'd been working on Wall Street for only a day. Why would my husband be concerned about when Josh got to work? Josh had a great work ethic. He'd be at work on time, or even knowing him, early. I answered, no, it's almost 9 o'clock in New York. Josh would be at work. Why are we talking about Josh's work? What's up? Turn on the TV, my husband said. An airplane accidentally crashed into the World Trade Center. I dropped the phone and called to my cousin, turn on the TV. First, there was a never-ending loop of a plane crashing into the World Trade Center's North Tower. My younger son, Dan, now awake, came out of the bedroom. What's going on? He said, still in his pajamas and rubbing his eyes. The two of us, Carol and I, managed to mumble something like, a plane's hit the World Trade Center. We don't know what's going on or where Josh is. Dan said, oh, Josh's office is far away from there. I didn't realize I hadn't been breathing until I heard myself let out a long breath. Then the second plane hit the South Tower. The three of us, Carol, Dan, and me, now all parked on the futon in front of the television set, jumped in our seats. The second plane was proof that this was no accident. Was this a war? A war happening in New York with Josh there and me in Milwaukee? My cousin began to sob. As for me, I was no longer in my body. I was inside my head. Chanting, praying, figuring, Josh isn't there. I know he isn't. Josh is alive. I would feel it if he weren't. But I was terrified by the possibility that I could be wrong. The phone rang. I froze in my seat. Should I answer? This could be the call that ends life as I know it, a call that tells me something I don't ever want to hear. Josh, Josh, I prayed, be safe. I missed him already. I picked up the phone. Hello, Mom, I heard. Oh, my God, it's you. It was Josh, and the tears started coming. Are you okay? I said. Yes, but we saw everything from the roof of our building, and they're telling us to stay here in the building. I'm not sure what I should do yet. I said, follow your instincts. If your instincts say to go, then go, whatever they say. Where are you? How far away are you? Josh said, I'm on Liberty, a block and a half away. I looked over at Dan. Josh said, I love you. I said, I love you too, honey. My dad always used to tell me and tell my sister, almost like a mantra, take care of my girl. I said, take care of my boy. I'm using someone's cell phone. I got to get off, he said. I think I'm going to run, he said. Trust yourself, I said, and be careful. He hung up. I wanted to beam him over or beam myself over there to comfort him. I think it was around then that the towers collapsed. My cousin Carol decided to go home. People like to be around their families when they feel frightened. To think that one ordinary Indian summer day in Wisconsin could turn into the tragedy of the decade in my New York, and my son could be there while I was here. As we came to learn, thousands lost their lives and thousands more were to be lost in Iraq. My son later told me he and a bunch of other people ran through the smoke of the collapsed buildings. They ran along the water towards New York's Greenwich Village, coughing and trying to outrun the dust and debris aftermath of the tower's collapse. All the subways were shut down, so Josh couldn't get back to Queens, where his apartment was, until late that night. At least he was alive. After Josh's call, I took my New Yorker shopping cart and went to Sendex, right down the street, to buy canned goods and bottled water. This is what New Yorkers do in an emergency. At least walking back and forth to Sendex, stocking up on canned goods, felt less disempowering. Oddly, it felt as if I were doing something. I don't think all of it really sank in until years later. I should have visited my son after 9/11, but when we heard the stories about people who were on the suicide planes, I became terrified to fly. In my head, I would see myself on a plane with terrorists, and I just couldn't go anywhere. Sometimes I wonder, if 9/11 hadn't happened, would things have turned out differently in our little lives? If I had known that his stepfather and I would divorce, would I have overcome my fear and been in New York with Josh, at least to be comforting after his trauma and the loss of his job? And if I had, would things be different now? After the World Trade Center attack, my son Josh couldn't find a job here in the States. So he moved to Spain and then to France, where he lives now, 10 years later. Whenever I miss him, and I miss him a lot, I tell myself, at least he's alive. I have to be glad of that. September 11th was a day of mass mourning. Some lives were changed in large and tragic ways on that day and in the 10 years that followed. My life and the life of my son Josh were changed in more subtle, almost imperceptible ways. Oddly, I remember a dream I had before Josh was born. The dream was that I had a son with an unusual name. Back then, no one heard the name Josh. I dreamt that there was a huge explosion, but that my son survived it. In my dream, there was something else, but I don't remember what. Some other loss the explosion had brought. Take two, New Yorker in Milwaukee, September 11th, 2001. My husband and I had moved to Milwaukee from New York for his work. And though I had no family in Milwaukee, my cousin Carol from Urbana, Illinois, came out to visit me. She came by around breakfast time, and we walked outdoors into a lovely, balmy, Indian summer kind of Wisconsin day. We had our breakfast near where I lived then, not far from the Downer Theater, Schwartz's Bookstore, Einstein Bagels, Starbucks, and Sendex. Carol and I returned from Einstein's with leftovers for my son Dan, who was living with me and my husband, as Dan took his pre-med classes at UWM. And just as we entered the apartment, my phone rang. It was my husband. He didn't say hello, and I don't recall his saying my name. He said the following, Josh probably isn't at work yet. A total non sequitur. How strange, I thought. Why does he care whether Josh was at work yet, and why would I care? My older son, Josh, had finished his New York stockbroker's exams and landed a job with an investment firm. He had been working on Wall Street for only a day. Why would my husband be concerned about when Josh got to work? Josh had a great work ethic. He'd be at work on time, or even knowing him, early. I answered, no, it's almost 9 o'clock in New York. Josh would be at work. Why are we talking about Josh's work? What's up? Turn on the TV, my husband said. An airplane accidentally crashed into the World Trade Center. I dropped the phone and called to my cousin, "Turn on the TV!" First, there was a never-ending loop of a plane crashing into the World Trade Center's North Tower. My younger son, Dan, now awake, came out of the bedroom. "What's going on?" he said, still in his pajamas and rubbing his eyes. The two of us, Carol and I, managed to mumble something like, "A plane's hit the World Trade Center, and we don't know what's going on or where Josh is." Dan said, "Oh, Josh's office is far away from there." I didn't realize I hadn't been breathing until I heard myself let out a long breath. Then the second plane hit the South Tower. The three of us, Carol, Dan, and me, now all parked on the futon in front of the television set, jumped in our seats. The second plane was proof that this was no accident. Was this a war? A war happening in New York with Josh there and me in Milwaukee? My cousin began to sob. As for me, I was no longer in my body. I was inside my head, chanting, praying, figuring, "Josh isn't there. I know he isn't. Josh is alive. I would feel it if he weren't." But I was terrified by the possibility that I could be wrong. The phone rang. I froze in my seat. Should I answer? This could be the call that ends life as I know it. A call that tells me something I don't want to hear. "Josh, Josh," I prayed, "be safe. I missed him already." The phone rang, and I picked it up. "Hello, Mom," I heard. "Oh, my God, it's you." It was Josh, and the tears started coming. "Are you okay?" I said. "Yes, but we saw everything from the roof of our building, and they're telling us to stay here in the building. I'm not sure what I should do yet." I said, "Follow your instincts. If your instincts say to go, then go. Where are you? How far away are you?" Josh said, "I'm on Liberty Street, a block and a half away." I looked over at Dan. Josh said, "I love you." I said, "I love you too, honey." My dad always used to tell me and tell my sister almost like a mantra, "Take care of my girl." And I said, "Take care of my boy." "I'm using someone's cell phone. I got to get off," he said. "I think I'm going to run," he said. "Trust yourself," I said, and then, "Be careful." And he hung up. I wanted to beam him over or beam myself over there to comfort him. I think it was around then that the towers collapsed. My cousin Carol decided to go back home. People like to be around their families when they feel frightened. To think that one ordinary Indian summer day in Wisconsin could turn into the tragedy of the decade in my New York, and my son could be there while I was here. As we came to learn, thousands lost their lives, and thousands more were to be lost in Iraq. My son later told me he and a bunch of other people ran through the smoke of the collapsed buildings. They ran along the water towards New York's Greenwich Village, coughing and trying to outrun the dust and debris aftermath of the tower's collapse. All the subways were shut down, so Josh couldn't get back to Queens, where his apartment was, until late that night. At least he was alive. After Josh's call, I took my New Yorker shopping cart and went to Sendix right down the street to buy canned goods and bottled water. This is what New Yorkers do in an emergency. At least walking back and forth to Sendix, stocking up on canned goods, felt less disempowering. Oddly, it felt as if I were doing something. I don't think all of it really sank in until years later. I should have visited my son after 9/11. But when we heard the stories about the people who were on the suicide planes, I became terrified to fly. In my head, I would see myself on a plane with terrorists, and I just couldn't go anywhere. Sometimes I wonder, if 9/11 hadn't happened, would things have turned out differently in our little lives? If I'd known that his stepfather and I would divorce, would I have overcome my fear and been in New York with Josh, at least to be comforting after his trauma and the loss of his job? And if I had, would things be different now? After the World Trade Center attack, my son Josh couldn't find a job here in the States. So he moved to Spain and then to France, where he lives now, 10 years later. Whenever I miss him, and I miss him a lot, I tell myself, at least he's alive. I have to be glad of that. September 11th was a day of mass mourning. Some lives were changed in large and tragic ways on that day and in the 10 years that followed. My life and the life of my son Josh were changed in more subtle, almost imperceptible ways. Oddly, I remember a dream I had before Josh was born. The dream was that I had a son with an unusual name. Back then, the name Josh was unusual. I dreamt that there was a huge explosion, that my son survived it. In my dream, there was something else, but I don't remember what. Some other loss the explosion had brought.
Linda Benjamin is a clinical social worker in private practice in Milwaukee. She's been a news broadcaster and has hosted a live call-in self-help show on a New York radio station. Her essay first appeared on this show 2 years ago. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.